Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 27. It's June 4th, 2020. It was May 14. In a few days, my class back in Jamestown, North Dakota, would be graduating from high school. And I was in Singapore. The date is one of the few I know from those knockabout years, simply because I had the good sense to write it on the inside cover of a book I bought at the shop of Mohammed Dulfakir on the corner of High Street. The book was Kipling's Departmental Ditties, and my reason for buying it was that I had forgotten a line or two from a poem I liked to recite, The Ballad of Fisher's Boarding House. During those years, I often recited poetry in bunkhouses, in mining or lumber camps, and in ships' forecastles. It was usually the verse of Robert W. Service or Rudyard Kipling, but there was a lot of poetry floating around for and often by the kind of men we were, occasionally printed, but usually passed from memory to memory. On that day, several of my shipmates had gathered around a table or two in the Maypole Bar, a place no doubt long forgotten. Such men as Hans the Blue-Eyed Dane of Kipling's poem would have known it, and probably British soldiers stationed in town. It was a nondescript bar, convenient to the waterfront. This is not the story of how I came to be in Singapore. That will be told elsewhere. This is a story of an adventure in education, pursued not under the best of conditions. The idea of education has been so tied to schools, universities, and professors that many assume there is no other way. But education is available to anyone within reach of a library, a post office, or even a newsstand. Today, you can buy the Dialogues of Plato for less than you would spend on a fifth of whiskey, or Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire for the price of a cheap shirt. You can buy A Fair Beginning of an Education in any bookstore with a good stock of paperback books for less than you would spend on a week's supply of gasoline. Often I hear people say they do not have time to read. That's absolute nonsense. In the 1 year during which I kept that kind of record, I read 25 books while waiting for people. In offices, applying for jobs, waiting to see a dentist, waiting in a restaurant for friends, many such places. I read on buses, trains, and planes. If one really wants to learn, one has to decide what is important. Spending an evening on the town, attending a ball game, or learning something that can be with you your life long. Byron's Don Juan I read on an Arab dhow sailing north from the Aden up to the Red Sea to Port Tufik on the Suez Canal. Boswell's Life of Samuel Johnson I read while broke and on the beach in San Pedro. In Singapore, I came upon a copy of the Annals and Antiquities of Rajasthan by James Todd. It was in the library of a sort of YMCA for seamen, the name of which I've forgotten, but which any British sailor of the time would remember, for the British had established them in many ports for sailors ashore. At that time, I could no more than skim the James Todd book, reading only a few chapters before I was off to sea again. But a few years ago, I located a secondhand copy in a bookstore in Greenwich Village, and it now rests on a shelf in my own library, a source for several planned books. A great book begins with an idea, a great life with a determination. My life may be not great to others, but to me it has been one of steady progression, never dull, often exciting, often hungry, tired, and lonely, but always learning. Somewhere back down the years I decided, or my nature decided for me, that I would be a teller of stories. Decisions had to be made, and there was nobody but me to make them. My course altered a number of times, but never deviated from the destination I had decided upon. Whether this was altogether a matter of choice, I do not know. Perhaps my early reading and the storytelling at home had preconditioned me for the role I adopted. Somewhere along the line, I had fallen in love with learning, and it became a lifelong romance. Early on, I discovered it was fun to follow the byways of history to find those treasures that await any searcher. It may be that all later decisions followed naturally from that first one. One thing has always been true. That book, or that person who gave me an idea or a new slant on an old idea, is my friend. And there have been many such. Right here, I wish to say that what follows is not an autobiography, although no doubt these materials are a piece of the final picture, which I hope to undertake later. As can be guessed from the title, this book is about education, but not education in the accepted sense. No man or woman has a greater appreciation for schools than I, although few have spent less time in them. No matter how much I admire our schools, I know that no university exists that can provide an education. What a university can provide is an outline to give the learner a direction and guidance. The rest, one has to do for oneself. If I were asked what education should give, I would say it should offer breadth of view, ease of understanding, tolerance for others, and a background from which the mind can explore in any direction. Education should provide the tools for a widening and deepening of life, for increased appreciation of all one sees or experiences. It should equip a person to live life well, to understand what is happening about him. For to live life well, one must live with awareness. No one can get an education, for of necessity, education is a continuing process. If it does nothing else, it should provide students with the tools for learning, acquaint them with methods of study and research, methods of pursuing an idea. We can only hope they come upon an idea they wish to pursue. In the United States, we have concentrated tremendous sums of money on the educational plant, seemingly with the idea that the right number of buildings will turn out the right number of graduates. Yet the teachers who actually instruct the future citizens of our country are more often than not miserably paid. If in the future we find ourselves with a lot of fourth-rate citizens, we have only ourselves to blame. Education depends on the quality of the teacher, not the sight or beauty of the buildings, nor, I might add, does it depend on the winning record of the football team. And I like football. It is constantly reiterated that education begins in the home, as indeed it does. But what is often forgotten is that morality begins in the home also. It also begins in the car seat, where many a budding criminal career is born when the child not only watches his parent repeatedly break traffic laws, but hears him lie about it when caught. The example is not supposedly expected to influence the child. My own education, which is the one I know most about, has been haphazard, a hit-and-miss affair that was and continues to be thoroughly delightful. I came into the world with two priceless advantages, good health and a love of learning. When I left school at the age of 15, I was halfway through the 10th grade. I left for two reasons, economic necessity being the first of them. More important was that school was interfering with my education. Due to circumstances, it was essential that I go to work and try to support myself. This was no sacrifice, for it had been uppermost in my mind for some time. Several factors contributed to my discontent. My first job was as a messenger boy for the Western Union, a good job for a boy in my hometown. I got the job when I was 12, and it was in the telegraph office that I first began to type. I cannot say that I learned to type. I began with two fingers and work with them still. It has been called the hunt and peck system, but over the years my fingers have become so used to the typewriter that I hunt very little and peck a lot. Also, I was growing rapidly. At 12, I was the size of most other boys. At 13 and a half, I was at my present height, which is 6 feet 1 inch. The very effort of growing left me often tired. Through the first 6 grades, my own grades were good, always at the top or close to the top. As a matter of fact, I was usually second, third, or fourth in the class, except in math. In my 6th grade, where we had a teacher who loved math, I several times made an A, or what corresponded to it. Moving into the 7th grade, I discovered I had several compulsory subjects in which I considered myself qualified, at least to the extent provided by the school text. It was essential that I take a semester of ancient history, and I had already done much reading in the area. I wished to skip the subject and take modern history, of which I knew very little. I also wished to skip general science and take chemistry. At the time, I had helped build several crystal radio sets and had done some electroplating. At the library, I had read from books on botany and geology. Actually, the book on general science I read in the city library was much better, as well as much more interesting than the school text, but the rules made no provisions for exceptions. I did not look forward to spending time studying subjects already covered. Ours was a family in which everybody was constantly reading and where literature, politics, history, and the events of the prize ring were discussed at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We grew up with the names of H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw, John L. Sullivan, Bob Fitzsimmons, and Jack Dempsey as familiar to us as those of our own family, right along with Teddy Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, Sitting Bull, and Crazy Horse. The Apache Wars, of which I was to write later, occurred far away to the southwest, but the Sioux were close by. They had killed and scalped my own great-grandfather while he was with the Sibley Command, pursuing the Santee Sioux across the Dakota in the aftermath of the bloody Little Crow Massacre of 1862. My education in domestic and foreign affairs began at home. My sister Edna was attending Jamestown College, and my two older brothers and a second sister were in school, constantly discussing and arguing about schoolwork, reciting poetry, and talking of books they were reading. How many books we had in our home, I do not remember, and doubt if anyone ever counted. We had collections of Longfellow, Whittier, Lowell, and Emerson, as well as the Stoddard lectures on travel. All of us had library cards, and they were always in use. Reading was as natural to us as breathing. When I moved on from children's books and fairy tales, one of the first books I read was Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. I had begun reading earlier than most because my sister Emmy Lou, no doubt to keep me from bothering her, decided it was easier to teach me to read stories to myself rather than read them to me, as she had been doing. What books I read immediately after that, or their progression, I do not remember. But certainly, they were for a time the simplest of children's books. I do know that when I was in the fifth grade, my father told me he would give me a 3-volume history of the world if I would read it. The books had come as a premium with a subscription to Collier's magazine. If I recall correctly, for the few months when my father came home, I would sit on his knee and tell him what I had read during the day. The books had a buff binding, a good many pictures, and fairly large print, so they must have been very general indeed. Other books remembered from those years were Black Beauty, a similar book about a dog called Beautiful Joe, who was not beautiful at all, Little Lord Fauntleroy, Pilgrim's Progress, which I found very dull, John Halifax, Gentleman, and two old favorites, Cudjoe's Cave and The Little Shepherd of Kingdom Come. My older brothers had left behind a dozen Horatio Alger novels, which I read, but I remember only 3 titles, Brave and Bold, Do and Dare, and Jed the Poor House Boy. About the same time, I read at least a dozen novels by G.A. Henty, a British author. The only 2 recalled offhand were The Lion of the North, about Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden, and With Clive in India. Aside from teaching much more about aspects of history studied in school, they provided at least passing familiarity with events our schools did not touch upon. These deepened my interest in history and brought not questions, but rather a desire to know more about what actually happened and why. Historical novels are, without question, the best way of teaching history, for they offer the human stories behind the events and leave the reader with a desire to know more. Due to such books and later reading, I found that no matter what country I visited or whom I met, I knew something of the history of or romance of the country or about a person's homeland. My father, who was a veterinarian working mostly with horses and cattle, was a great storyteller. In small towns in those days, nearly every public official had some other business, and my father was at various times a deputy sheriff, a policeman, a juvenile commissioner, and for many years was alderman of the First Ward, the largest in the city. At one time, he even ran for mayor, but was defeated by a good friend. He told stories of his boyhood in the lumber woods, of a pet bear and deer he owned, of a Huron Indian boy with whom he played. My mother, too, told stories, usually of her relatives in Minnesota or her father, a veteran of the Civil and Indian Wars who lived with us when I was very small. Supposedly, I was too young to remember him well, but often when we were alone, he drew diagrams on a slate and told me how the great battles were fought and about some of his own wars. I should not have remembered, but years later, I could draw a diagram of how the Battle of Cana was won, and I did not study that until later. That is the introduction to The Education of a Wandering Man by Louis L'Amour, who wrote a gigantic amount, number of westerns, novels. I think the copyright, I think this was written or printed in 1989. Growing up, that was always a tried and true sort of Father's Day gift or gift from my dad. He loved Louis L'Amour. I think there's still an entire bookshelf or section of a bookshelf in our house that has basically every book that man ever wrote. This is a great book. If you've never read it or heard of it, I recommend it. It's fascinating. Great opening line. His high school graduating class about to walk across the stage. He's in Singapore on the other side of the world. And his take just here on education is wonderful and refreshing. He left school simply, I mean, it sounds, A, as you mentioned, A, economic necessity. B, he was irritated at being forced through fixed channels when he'd already studied and knew certain material and wanted to adapt his own path. Obviously, that's a topic that's racing around schooling and education in this country right now. I also appreciate, you know, we've been last few days talking history and geography and geopolitics, and his notion of just bouncing from book to book to book around the world and through time as a way to peek in on different places and learn, and his whole idea of education is a continuing process, not a thing you get, and it never ends, and that what you're learning is how to learn throughout it all. And so the more you know, the more you realize you don't know, and all of that kind of stuff. And the agency that he had to take charge of his own education. This will be yet another book that I probably go back to from time to time. And I have stuff from Wendell Berry and John Taylor Gatto and all kinds of figures to weave into the mix. And I would also just drop here too another plug for a library card. Library cards are, and the Austin Library is amazing. Libraries in every town are amazing. The ability to go grab books, thumb through them quickly, deep dive into them, move around, is wonderful. And for him to also to have that kind of recollection for what he read and when and where it came from, and talking about how it's a choice we all make in the moment. How are we going to spend our time? Watch a ball game, watch a show, read a book, and to not squander that. And he wrote this book in 1989 talking about his youth, and he was already an older gentleman when he wrote this book. So his youth was long ago. Certainly no smartphones, no web, none of that. All analog tools. And so even sort of in that era with what he had, the tools he had at his disposal then, always having a little book in his pocket, always at the ready to read. And of course these days it's insane, the embarrassment of riches before us, that we can just go grab from almost any library, from almost anything in history, and fire off on our own, is a wonderful thing. And I guess part of the message too is, rather than getting bogged down and spending too much time trying to structure everything and trying to pick up a book, start reading. If you don't like it, move on to the next one, and keep reading. It's wonderful. The Education of Wandering Man, Louis L'Amour. Fantastic stuff. We'll revisit soon. Y'all have a great weekend. Thanks.